Welcome back to the FKT podcast. I'm your host, Heather Anderson. Today we're chatting with Callie Vinson, who set the supported FKT on Arizona's 240-mile Maricopa Loop in just over 4 days. Join us to hear about her journey from being unable to walk 1 mile to setting a 200-plus-mile long FKT. Thank you so much, Callie, for coming on the show today. I'm really excited to chat with you.
Yes, thank you for inviting me. I'm excited to chat.
So today we're going to talk about your FKT on the Maricopa Loop. And that's in Arizona, and I don't think it's like a very commonly known route. So I was wondering if you could just describe what the Maricopa Loop is for our listeners.
Yeah, the Maricopa Loop is this complete loop that encircles all of Phoenix. So it hits the major mountain ranges all around the Phoenix area, Scottsdale area, Gilbert, all what we call the valley. And so you get every view you could possibly imagine of the desert.
And how long is it?
It's about 241 miles for the FKT, but the Maricopa Trail, if you wanted to do all the fun little offshoots, I think it would total about 315. But everyone's been doing the 240, and I was like, you know what? I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I imagine that all the little offshoots add a lot of elevation because they probably go to summits.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I noticed on the site, and correct me if I'm wrong, but on the site, this is listed as your only FKT. So I'm curious what makes you take on a 240-mile loop as your first FKT?
I think maybe that just speaks to my history. My first race that I ever did was the Chicago Marathon. I didn't do a 5K or, you know, half marathon. I just went right in. And then first ultra was a 50-mile trail. And then I just kind of doubled or nothing from there. So 50 to 100 to 200. So my spirit is kind of go big or go home. So I mean, my heart was set on this and nothing was going to change my mind once I decided it was a go.
I love that approach. I have also never run like shorter than a marathon. Well, I guess I have run like a 5K, but I ran an ultra marathon first. I've never run a marathon and stopped. I like to tell people, just keep going.
Yeah, exactly.
So obviously, like, you know, going big or going home is your personality. Can you talk a little bit about your journey as a runner and a mountain athlete? Like, how did you just end up going from the couch to running the Chicago Marathon? Like, what is this journey looking like for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, the journey goes back, what, we're in 2020. So 10 years, I started my health journey. I guess you could start there. And it started with not even being able to walk a mile around a, you know, around my neighborhood. And I always tell the story, it was when my friend asked me to go to brunch one day and said, oh yeah, we're just going to walk there. And of course I Googled it because I wanted to see what I wanted to eat. But then I realized it was a mile away and I was terrified because there was absolutely no way I could go that far. And that triggered my health journey. It was this major red flag that said, hey, you've got to do something about your lifestyle. If you moved to Chicago, which is where I was living, and you have all these big dreams, but you're limiting yourself and what you can do and being able to achieve any of those dreams. And so it started small with just trying to run around my block, then running a mile, 2 miles, 4 miles. And because I didn't run any races before the marathon, it was because I was too nervous to run among other people because I was so afraid of what they were going to say or judge me or be like, oh my gosh, what is she wearing? Or is that her running form? So I would only run in the dark when I started and eventually, you know, got up to a half marathon distance just around my neighborhood. And I was like, you know what, if I can do that, maybe I could run a marathon. And I was inspired by the newspaper one morning featuring the Chicago Marathon. I was like, there's no way I could run a marathon. But then my next thought was I have to run a marathon. And in that journey, I ended up losing 200 pounds too. So I guess that was a something that happened as well. But with that spirit of just jumping into a marathon, jumping into a trail, 50 miler, being a terrible trail runner, not knowing anything about it, that spirit just kind of carried into my last effort, which was just figuring out an FKT along the way, I guess, and getting it done, apparently.
Wow, that's an incredible journey. Do you mind sharing how old you were and when you did that, like Googled the 1 mile and were afraid to to walk that far?
Yeah, I was I guess I was about 26. Yeah.
Okay.
26 years old. And as a kid I played sports, soccer, But I was the goalie because I hated running, and I figured as a goalie, I don't have to run very far. And then because I also lived up in Florida, I got into rowing because everyone was on a rowing team or a crew team. And you're in a boat, so you don't have to run in a boat. So that's why I love those two sports. But running was something that I always hated. It was just like my nemesis. And that one day in Chicago, I realized, you know, if you can conquer running, maybe you can conquer anything. So it became my mission. I put my blinders on and just kind of went after it.
I love that. I think there's actually a lot of similarities between your story and mine. And I definitely feel myself like nodding along. Like, you know, when I was in college, I discovered hiking and decided I wanted to go hike the Appalachian Trail. So I'm the same sort of thing of like, I have no business doing this, but this is huge thing and it sounds awesome and I want to do it. But I also hated running with a passion. Yeah. I was, you know, overweight and sedentary. I did not play sports as a kid. And I do remember like I couldn't run around the track without getting winded. I had to walk and going out there and on my college campus and running around the track at night in the dark until I could finally waddle 8 miles. And I was so proud, you know, and you know, just like going from there, because now, you know, I love running.
Now it's all I think about and all I want to do. And
one of these great ironies, you know.
So weird how it works out that way.
So you mentioned that you were living in Chicago. Do you live in Arizona now? Or
I do.
Did you go to Arizona? Okay. Like I say, the Chicago to Arizona thing would be a big adjustment for running in the desert, because running in the desert is very different.
Yeah. And it's funny because even in Chicago, I never really ran on, I mean, they were technically trails, but it was very groomed, very wide dirt roads kind of. The trails that I would run on, I was too nervous to go on more technical terrain than that. Mm-hmm. So it was when I moved to Scottsdale, what was that? 2.5 years ago, that's when I jumped into trail running for real, and learned that I'm absolutely terrible at it. And I still am, but I call myself a newborn giraffe on the trails because I'm tall and I don't know how to use my limbs very well. And I'm very clumsy, but I love it. As a kid, I was always outdoors. I was always getting dirty. I was barefoot, playing with bugs. And, the day that I learned that you could do this running thing outside and in the wilderness, I was like, oh, this is what was meant for me. I didn't realize it until now, but now I'll happily spend days outside running for with no sleep and dirty, and it's the best thing ever.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. And I don't know, I've been on trails a lot over the last 20 years and I still like run into trees with my shoulders because I apparently don't know how wide I am.
No.
So, you know, at least you're in the desert, you don't run into trees. It's cactus, which probably is worse. So kind of switching gears to your FKT. Mm-hmm. And so you did this supported. Mm-hmm. But I was reading your trip report and it sounds like the very first night you were by yourself and found yourself bushwhacking through the desert. Yes. So bushwhacking through the desert is not the best thing. As we just mentioned, there's cactus and lots of other pokey things. Mm-hmm. So can you tell me about, number one, why you were alone? And number two, why you were bushwhacking on a standard FKT trail?
Yeah, so I decided for the first 100 miles or so, I would just go by myself. No pacers. I would have support crew, but I didn't need pacers. I'm used to doing 100 milers by myself without crew or pacers. It's just kind of how I learned in the sport or in the beginning stages. And so I was like, you know what? I don't need to waste my resources in these first 100 miles. I can do it on my own. And so the first day and a half, I decided to tackle the harder sections first because I knew I'd have the most energy. I'd still, you know, have some sleep from whatever night that was before Tuesday night. So I was like, okay, I'll do the hardest sections first. And a lot of the sections I am familiar with because of all the races that Aravaipa puts on here, and use a lot of those trails. And so I was like, okay, I know most of them. But there was this one stretch where I knew it was going to be unfamiliar territory, but because it was in the same mountain range, I'm like, well, it can't be that different, right? It's going to be the same.
Famous last words.
I mean, I don't need to do any recon on this area. Like, waste of time. It'll be fine. And so I get into the night and it's dark and I'm by myself and it's getting cold. Believe it or not, it gets very cold in the desert. 50 is very cold. You know, when you've been in the sun all day. But I get to this section where it was very clear that not a lot of people have been in that section recently. if at all. I know it was, you know, official trail, but no one was going on it very clearly. It was very, very overgrown to the point where you couldn't see the trail underneath the overgrown areas. So you kind of had to use your, what I was saying, your trail instincts to know which way to go. Of course, I had it on my phone, but I didn't want to have to, you know, have my phone out the whole time. But I would just notice like where maybe the trail looked a little lighter because, you know, feet have been on that area versus this other area where it looked a little darker. So I just kind of like bulldozed through these overgrown sections, and which included a lot of claws and a lot of thorns and a lot of angry bushes that were just latching onto my legs as I went through and pulling me back. But I was just, we've got to get through it. But because it was overgrown, there were some parts where I went the wrong way. And so I'd have to go back through it and then through the right section again. But yeah, that was fun. Also a lot of down trees, down cactuses that I have to step over and accidentally step on a cactus. So that was fun too. But luckily I made it out of there somewhat unscathed. My legs are still a little scratched up, but I made it out, and I had a burrito waiting for me at the end. So that was kind of like the carrot that I was dangling. And
right. Yeah. I mean, food and sleep, those are good motivators to go through just about anything.
Yeah.
How many miles had you done prior to hitting this nasty bushwhack?
Not very many. 40, I would say.
Okay.
Around that area. So not, I felt very fresh. I was still like loving the nighttime. I was like, ooh, this is nice. I can see everything still clearly, you know. I hadn't started seeing things yet, so it was fine. It was not fine in the moment, but getting out of it, I was like, oh yeah, everything's fine.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I feel like that definitely is like a good time to be hitting something like that and not, you know, at mile like 200.
Oh, I would have cried. I would have stopped and I would have said like, this is enough.
Right. Yeah. I'm done.
Scratching my leg. I would have been like, that's it. We're done. Yep.
Oh my gosh. Yes. So you mentioned you weren't seeing things yet. So that implies at some point you were. Yes. Can you talk about your sleep strategy throughout this and also maybe what you experienced with sleep deprivation along the way?
Yeah, so I used a similar strategy that I used during the Moab 240 ultramarathon, which was about every day getting around 2 hours of sleep, or at least like laying down for 2 hours and then getting up, having about 30 minutes before I laid down, but once I got to the aid station, and 30 minutes after to then get up and move. And that worked really well for me in Moab. And I decided we're going to do that again for this. And the first night I did not sleep very well. I think maybe I got like an hour, 20 hour, 30 of sleep. And I'm not sure why that was. I think I was just still hyped up on Dr. Pepper, maybe. I don't know. But I continued that strategy for Wednesday night, Thursday night, Friday night, and then I didn't sleep Saturday night because I was like, okay, I know I'm going to finish in the daytime Sunday. I don't need to belabor this. I can just power through. And so, of course, it was the Saturday night, the last night, where I started to like, it wasn't like that I was seeing things, but my brain was so tired that it couldn't make out what it actually was. So it was seeing the first thing that it recognized, which were really large teddy bears in people's backyards. I mean, it looked like a cartoon teddy bear was just like sitting in this person's backyard, but I knew it was actually a palm tree just lit really weirdly, but in my mind it was a big teddy bear. And then so that was a fun thing to see. But then later, when I was literally falling asleep while moving, my pacer had to move me away from the canal because I was about to fall into it.
Oh my gosh.
So I was more close. I was closer to the trees right by me. And they looked like that scene in The Little Mermaid where Ursula's like doing her song and these little like souls are coming up from the ground. The little baby people thing. Okay. Those were the trees that were like reaching over to me. And I was like, we just got to power through. To get through this. I don't want to look to my left. I know it's a tree, but it doesn't look like a tree right now.
And were you singing, like, you know, the poor unfortunate souls song in your head?
poor unfortunate souls were in my head. They were next to me. I was one of them. And I just knew that I just need to make it to sunrise. I just need for the sun to come up and I will be okay. Mm-hmm. But in this moment, I'm about to fall asleep. And I almost took a little dirt nap, but it was just too cold. I had to keep moving. Otherwise, I definitely would have gotten hypothermic. So that was a fun moment.
Sounds like it was a good time to have a pacer with you.
Very good time to have a pacer and pushing a stroller. So I wasn't carrying much. I just had my poles to like just keep trekking along.
Yeah, I noticed the stroller in one of your pictures. What was the stroller for? Like, I'm curious about the stroller.
Yeah, so, I mean, when I've done a 200 before, almost the worst part about it is the stuff that you're carrying on your shoulders. It just weighs on you physically and mentally. And I wasn't even thinking about this, but the last section, once I passed South Mountain, the last, I think it was 55 miles, was going to be just canal paths and sidewalks. And my partner, Scott, was like, well, why don't you just get a stroller? Like, do what Pete did across America and just put all your stuff in it and push it. And I was like, that's a good idea, actually. So I went on Facebook Marketplace, looked for a used stroller, a jogging stroller, and found one and tried it out for like two or three runs. And I was like, this is perfect. So as soon as I got out of South Mountain, I put all my stuff in the stroller and I bedazzled it and put some like fun things on it to like make me happy whenever the stroller came out in that moment, and it worked. So
that's awesome. Yeah. I love that. Did you have anybody stopping you like wanting to see your baby?
So good thing not during the actual run, but definitely when I was training. So I would train, you know, in the morning and go out with my stroller for my 5-hour run. And I disappointed so many grandparents and parents because I'd see their face just become very excited to see, oh, what are we going to see in the basket? And there would be just my hydration vest. And they were like, oh, like something okay with her. Cause I mean, I probably looked crazy without no baby in there, but then they saw that there was no baby. And then I just became definitely a crazy person.
They went from disappointment to, I'm going to get away from this person.
I'm a little faster right now. Exactly.
It sounds like you need a little sign that says there is no baby in here. Yeah. Just to forestall disappointment.
Sorry, but there's no child. I just have a dog.
Baby not included.
Yeah, no.
Oh my goodness. So you mentioned practicing with the stroller and you did mention Moab. What was your training for this Maricopa Loop like?
It was very similar to like a 100 or a 200, just, you know, a little bit more time on weekends. But during the weekdays, I mean, I have a very busy schedule. I work full time and then kind of part time freelance for other stuff I do socially. So weekdays, it's like an hour 15 I would spend towards training on Tuesday through Friday. And then Saturday it would be heavier training load. So Saturday, I might go out for like 6 or 8 hours of a run walk combo. And then Sunday, kind of do the same for like 5 hours or four or something like that. And then my one weekend where it was like the training camp weekend, I would do that, but plus Friday. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday, a long run. But mileage wise, I think my biggest mileage week was, I don't know, 66 miles, maybe 70. But I did that for Moab too. And in my mind, I'm like, how in the world am I going to train only this many miles a week? And then in 4 days, expect to go 240. But I trust my coach. And sure enough, it paid off 2 times. So
yeah,
I'll do the same for future 200 milers.
Do you do any other like types of training, any strength training, or are you just focus on the running?
No, I just do. I'm supposed to do strength training, but I never do. I have dumbbells right here. I have a gym membership, but yeah, just running and hiking.
I mean, you could just put those in the stroller and take those for a run, you know, when you're using them at least.
That counts.
That counts.
I think. Yeah.
Yep. I think so. I'm curious what your fueling strategy was like in this, because I've never run this far. So how was it different, or is it different from what you do in a 100 miler? Did you have any surprises or try new things out?
So, I mean, overall, this FKT went eerily well. And one of my biggest concerns, it wasn't going to be sleep. It wasn't going to be like if an injury pops up, it was my stomach. Mm-hmm. I have such a nervous stomach. My stomach is the biggest baby. It's so sensitive. And it got me during Cocodona. And then it almost got me during Moab. I mean, I tried to drop at mile 70 of Moab, but my people would not let me. So I just kept going. But it was because my stomach was just giving me such terrible issues for the entire course, to the point where I probably had maybe half a tortilla in my stomach at any time during Moab, and that was it. Ugh. So training for this, there was a huge focus on fuel. And what I found is I do really well with liquid calories. So I started using Goo Roctane, the Roctane mixes. They've got a couple different flavors. They've got a couple with caffeine. So I went back and forth using those in training. But primarily I use liquid calories. So it's great because I, like in the desert, I'm always thirsty. So I'm always going to be sipping something. And if I can sip and just like slowly intake calories and sodium too, which was a big focus as well. Then my stomach can absorb it and we can keep moving and not bonk or feel faded or tired because I'm not, fueled properly. And that worked really well. I mean, I went through, I refueled, my bladder, which was a 2-liter bladder at every aid station. And every aid station was about, I don't know, average 10 miles apart. And then I would just supplement with other like real foods. I would take the Goo Chews with me or the Stroop waffles and just kind of eat those whenever I felt like eating something. But it was never to the point where it was like a big thing in my stomach. I think, I guess it was a big thing. Every aid station or most aid stations I had a Chipotle burrito waiting for me.
Those are pretty big.
But what I got, I mean, I didn't get the whole thing at an eight. I would just get, you know, maybe like a third of it down. And then my crew would pack it up and have for me at the next aid station. And I would have another third of it. But I kept it very simple. It was just steak, white rice, and lettuce. And it was like just exactly what I needed to just feel like a little bit of comfort food and then keep going. But fueling wise, yeah, liquid calories are going to be my thing for a while now because I had absolutely no stomach issues, like nothing. So I mean, I went from like night and day from what I was used to in races to having a very smooth race for FKT.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of the people I've talked to on the podcast swear by the liquid calories, especially for the multi-day efforts. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it seems to solve a lot of issues for a lot of people.
It really does. And I thought it was such a weird thing at first when I first heard of a couple of friends using liquid calories. I'm like, that's so weird. I'm just going to drink water. Yeah. And then as soon as I switched, I'm like, okay, I see it now.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that it was cold at night. But was it hot during the day? Like, what was the weather like?
For late November here, I think the high got to like 70, but you know, that's full full sun exposure, no shade. We did have a couple cloudy mornings, which was very nice. But in the night it got to probably the high 40s. Which is very cold. It just feels very cold in the desert because it's so dry. And if you've been in the sun all day, like that's going to zap you. But so to me, it felt like a very stark contrast between the night and day weather. But, you know, I had a separate duffel bag for warm weather clothes and a separate one for cold weather clothes. So every time I got to the point where I needed to switch out, I had everything ready. You know, I've been training in the desert for a while, so I was used to it.
Right. Yeah.
You don't have
to. Let's talk a little bit more about your gear setup. You know, you mentioned you had a separate kit for day and night. So what were your mainstays? Like, what was your go-to?
So the daytime, I stuck with arm sleeves. I'm used to those because they're great for stuffing ice in, or you just wet them and they'll stay wet and keep you cool. So I always had arm sleeves. I ended up not using my ice bandana, but I did have a couple ice bandanas packed in there. And then I love just cotton t-shirts. Cotton in the desert works really well because if it stays wet, it's going to stay wet longer. And for me, it's just very comfortable to wear like a $2 Goodwill t-shirt versus like a very nice, you know, $60 high performance shirt. I'll take the Goodwill cotton shirt any day. So that was a big thing in my daytime hot weather kit. And then I wear long shorts, I guess, that are kind of like biker shorts. They're like 12 inches or whatnot. So those work really well for me. And then a big sun hat. I wore a big sun hat in the daytime just to block sun, because that was a number one strategy for the daytime, was just block the sun any way possible. And then as far as sun, I also have this little like stick that's, I think it's 30 or 50 for sunscreen, and you just kind of like stick it on to any exposed pieces. So this was like fully covered in sunscreen at all times. I looked crazy, but I was totally fine with that. And then my hands, because my hands were always using poles. So like this part of my thumb was always exposed. So I was always reapplying there. And then daytime, it was just a mix of a knit hat. I had, you know, a bunch of different thermal long sleeves and my Jonji jackets and whatnot. Some gloves.
Right. And I'm assuming a very bright headlamp. Did you use more than one?
So I use a waist lamp. And I like a waist lamp because headlamps, they just give me a headache. Again, sensitive body, sensitive head. So if anything's on my head for too long, I will get a headache. And also just the tunnel vision that I can get with headlamps. I've found that waist lamps work a lot better. So I use the Ultraspire. I think it's 800 lumen waist lamp. And I love it because, you know, it gives you a better depth of field of whatever's in front of you. So, and there was a ton of rocks on this excursion, so I could see the rocks really well. And, you know, I'm very clumsy, so it helped to trip less. But I never used a waist lamp or a headlamp. I just a waist lamp.
Do you find that the waist lamp stays in place when you're running?
Yeah, I usually wear it like on the high waist area and then just kind of like point it down, and there's no bounce or anything. It's kind of perfect.
Interesting. I might have to check that out. I have similar issues with the headlamp, but I don't like running the running waist belts, you know, like the water bottle thing. Like, they bounce around and they're super uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't either. But I think because it's so light and compared to like a waist belt, it helps a lot with that, because I hate also things around my stomach. It just makes me feel like I'm going to get a stomach ache or something.
Right.
So I wear this pretty loosely around like the waist part, and it works just fine.
That's awesome. I'm going to look into that myself.
It's one of those things where like, once I switched, I'm never going back to a headlamp.
I feel like the only thing I'd want a headlamp for is if, like, you know, you hear the noise and you're trying to look. And then it's like, oh, it's dark over there.
Yeah. You can't do that with a weight unless you turn your whole
body. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Would you change anything gear wise? Were you happy with all your choices? Was there anything you were out there and you're just like, oh, I'd never use this again, or I wish I had this?
Yeah, I don't think so. I'm pretty low maintenance gear wise, food wise, everything. If it worked, I kept going with it until it didn't work and change it, which didn't happen at all. Everything worked. I mean, yeah, I didn't change my shoes once. I wore the same shoes the whole time because they worked well for me. Socks, I only changed my socks once because they were starting to get a little like stiff, like decoupage around my toes. So I was like,
oh, yeah,
freshies on. But otherwise, two pairs of socks and a pair of shoes. I don't tape or lube my feet or anything. I just stick to that and it seems to work well. So I don't try and fix it. And then, yeah, nothing. I don't think so. And yeah, everything. I keep saying it just went eerily well. I never had a low moment. I never was sad. I never was like bawling in the corner. I was just like, okay, we're just keep going.
Yeah. And that was it. That's amazing. Yeah. To have such a long FKT go so well.
Nothing went wrong.
Yeah.
It was weird. I promise you. I'm still like, are we sure? Did I block anything out?
No. You're asking your crew people, like, so did things go wrong that I don't know about? Like,
That's a good question to ask them. I could probably ask Scott that.
How many people were on your crew? How did that work out logistically?
So this is, I would say, what made it go eerily well. I ended up having 26 people involved in this.
Oh, wow.
And so it went from me saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to do this unsupported, and then realize, oh, there's like no water in the desert, so I should probably do it supported. To me just throwing a post out there saying like, hey, I decided I'm going to do this supported. If you want to help, send me a message. And I had a flood, like, I think about 100 people reached out saying that they would help. They'll come out for this. They'll do whatever. They'll pace the night. They'll do multiple nights. They have a van that I could sleep in, which I ended up sleeping in the second night. And I think that really helped with everything going. It could have very easily gone wrong because of that many people and depending on a lot of people to be in those spots when you need them.
Yeah.
But everyone was there. Everyone showed up. So that worked really well.
That's always good.
Yeah. Some people that I was meeting for the first time, or like two of my pacers, I've never run with them before. And I was just like, you know what? We're just going to trust the community because this community looks out for each other. And
they
sure as shit did during this FKT. So, I 26 people, one person flew in from Texas to help out for this. And two girls drove in from San Diego, and then everyone else was local.
Wow, that's an incredible crew. That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm still blown away by it. And next Friday, I actually set up a pizza party where we're all going to go and celebrate now that we've all slept and whatnot.
Recovered a little.
Yeah.
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 That's awesome.
I'm going to have a pizza party for all of them.
I love that. I'm post FKT pizza party.
Yeah.
So what was your biggest takeaway from this FKT experience?
I think it was just that community. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm still, like I said, just blown away by what can happen when people come together with one mission. And we all came together with that one mission and we stuck to it and everything was just weirdly great and wonderful. And I met some amazing people and you just realize like how good this community is and how much, it just reminds you that humanity is still good in some spaces, but this is definitely one of them. And so I think that, my biggest takeaway was how wonderful the community is.
So you jumped right into FKTs with a 240 mile loop. What's next? Are there any 500 mile routes out there? Like, I mean, or 1,000? Like, I mean, I feel like that's on brand for you.
Right. You know, the only thing that's deterring me from doing anything like that is work. Mm-hmm. And so if it ever came to the point where, and I'm sure it is for most people, like if I had a month off, I would 100% go do something, you know, like that. But as of now, my next thing is, and I haven't like officially announced it, but I guess I can, I'm going to go after my redemption at Cocodona, which is in May. So the Cocodona 250 nice. Race here in Arizona. So just, you know, a few more miles.
Oh yeah. And you've probably seen a lot of or you've run the course, so you already know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're all set.
Fine.
No big deal. Mm-mm. Yeah. Well, I look forward to following along on that and all your adventures in between.
Heck yeah. I am excited. We'll see what else is next. I don't know. I figure it out every day.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing with us.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again, Callie, for coming on the show. You can read about her FKT on the website, fastestknowntime.com, and follow her adventures on Instagram, at Callie Vinson. I also want to give a special thank you to John G. for supporting the FKT podcast. John G. makes trail running essentials designed to go further, perfect for your next FKT. And beyond making super durable trail running apparel that's backed by a 5-year run everywhere guarantee, they also donate 2% of sales to clean water programs in the places we run. So far, John G has donated $1 million to clean water and counting. Take advantage of a 10% off coupon at johng.com with code FKT.